You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Egypt's newly elected President Mohamed Morsi is mingling with royals in Riyadh. We'll find out why Saudi made the cut as his first official trip abroad. The finance minister of Djibouti popped by Midori House earlier today. We'll see what's driving the economy of this tiny country in the Horn of Africa.
We started having free and fair elections, but at the same time, time has come now to make sure that minority are well represented into the parliament.
And Brisbane has just been awarded the 2014 G20 summit. But why was Sydney passed over? It may have something to do with a lack of parking space. Ralph Lauren has just revealed the London Olympic uniforms for the US team, and the brand signature pony is bigger than the American flag. Style columnist for the Wall Street Journal will tell us why. And we'll also have a chat with our design editor, Hugh McDonald. I'll play you a song or two. All that coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. Nine mountain climbers have been killed today in an avalanche near Chamonix in the French Alps, in the most deadly avalanche in the Alps since 2008, sweeping down a popular climbing route in the Mont Blanc region near the border with Switzerland. The dead include two Spaniards, three Germans and a Swiss. Two German and two British climbers are still missing. Syria's ambassador to Iraq has defected to the opposition, describing the regime of President Bashar al-Assad as brutal, as Britain and the United States drafted a resolution threatening sanctions. The United Nations peace envoy Kofi Annan called for Iran to be included in efforts to resolve the crisis, while the US ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, says Iran can't help to find the solution because it's part of the problem. But Alexander Pankin, Russia's deputy ambassador to the UN, disagreed.
Dismissing Iran on some political basis, it's not a very wise thing to do. If we want to talk to all parties, if we want to show all parties who have influence, and Iran is among those who has influence, we need to bring them at the table, disregarding what we think about their orientation or ideologies.
Staff at Libya's High Election Commission in Tripoli said they would announce preliminary results today, while official results were expected at the weekend. A crowd gathered outside the office as ballot boxes were unloaded to be counted, with people flashing a victory sign and singing Libya's national anthem. In Benghazi, at least 180 ballot boxes were being recounted after mistakes were noticed. New statistics show the unemployment rate in Greece has reached a new high of 22.5%. Out of a population of 11 million people, over 1.1 million are out of a job. Bianca Tampori, a translator, cannot find work, and her husband and 18-year-old daughter are also unemployed.
I'm concerned because I have a problem, my husband has a problem, all my family, we all have a problem. So, yes, I'm concerned about the future, our jobs, our lives, our psychology, you know, dignity, everything.
Budget cuts imposed by the European Union and the International Monetary Fund have caused a wave of business closures and bankruptcies, resulting in job cuts and a sharp drop in consumer spending. Meanwhile, health authorities have asked the Greeks to stay inside as chokingly hot temperatures of 112 Fahrenheit, 44 Celsius, have gripped the country. Nick Begara from Florida found the temperatures unbearable. Paolo Gabriele, Pope Benedict's butler, who was arrested on the 23rd of May on charges of leaking sensitive documents, will remain in custody for the time being, at least until the conclusion of an investigation in a few weeks' time, the Vatican has said today. Robert Mulhern, the editor of Inside the Vatican magazine, thought he might still be released.
They've extended it now for a few more days. Padre Lombardi said 10 days, maximum 15 days. And when that period is finished, he should be released to his home. And there should be formulated over the month of August some kind of accusation against him for a trial in the fall, or he might even be released.
And finally, a southern Chinese city is on the alert for piranhas after two people were attacked in a river and is offering a £100 reward for every fish caught, dead or alive. State media reported today the government of Guangxi is asking people to hunt the alien South American species, which badly bit two people early in the week who were paddling in the Lijiang River. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water. Thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley. It is 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyos. Seen on Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Lontoosta käsin, tämä on Monaco 24.
London Bo, as a Monaco 24.
Londadan, burası Monaco 24.
Londonist, sinun Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
O que que ninatteiru no wa Monaco 24.
Afto é no Monaco 24.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
Du lyssnar på Monaco 24.
Kuuntelet Monaco 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 talat, ja.
For a newly elected head of state, firsts are important, and they're noticed. First pieces of legislation passed, first treaties struck down, they're seen as telling signs of things to come. When it comes to the realm of international diplomacy, the choice for a leader's first official visit abroad is no different. President Obama, fresh off his victorious ascent to the Oval Office, hopped on Air Force One to the frigid February air of Canada. François Hollande didn't even wait for the ink to dry on his inauguration papers before he jetted off to Germany to meet Angela Merkel. And now Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected president, is making his first trip abroad, and it's to Saudi Arabia. The two countries have much in common. They're the biggest economies and the biggest players in the Arab world, and they've been allies, though at times testy allies, for decades. Post-revolution, how will the democratic Mr. Morsi get on with the autocratic King Abdullah? On the line now from Cairo is Eric Traeger, the Next Generation Fellow at the Washington Institute and expert in Egyptian politics. Eric, welcome to Midori House. Let's start by talking about this relationship between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Why is it so important?
Well, thanks for having me. It's important exactly for the reasons that you stated. These are the two most powerful, most influential countries in the Arab world. They're both Sunni countries. They're both historically, or at least in the last, let's say, 35 years, pro-Western, of course. Saudi Arabia has been pro-Western for much longer than that. And for this reason, especially, you know, from the West, we view this relationship as very critical to maintaining allies, especially against Iran, which, of course, has its own system of alliances in the region. So one way to look at this is that the old alliances that really shaped the region have not yet been affected by the election of Mohamed Morsi.
Now, many people in the West, thought that the possibility of an Islamist president in Egypt, Mohamed Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood, might mean that Egypt takes a different stance towards Israel, towards the US. Do you think that that's likely, or is it probable that Egypt will follow a similar line to Saudi when it comes to its relations with the West?
Well, I think it might follow a similar relationship to Saudi, but we have to remember that there are key differences. One of the major things that will make Egypt less likely to pursue a hostile path towards the United States is that Egypt, and the Muslim Brotherhood knows this, Egypt needs foreign support to rescue its struggling economy. That's the only thing that really seems to indicate that the Brotherhood might stay in line. But we have to remember that the Brotherhood is a historically hostile group towards the West, of course towards Israel. It has very frigid relations historically, even with Saudi Arabia, which has always mistrusted it. So this is an important trip for Morsi because it's setting aside some of those doubts that Saudi Arabia has about the Brotherhood, perhaps, But no one should take this as a sign that everything is okay. You know, just earlier today I was speaking to a top former Egyptian diplomat who said that after this trip, it's very likely that Morsi will go to Iran to attend the conference of the non-aligned movement. So this may just be a way to reassure Saudi Arabia that by visiting Iran, he's not throwing Saudi under the bus. But from the West, the image of the Brotherhood leader in Iran will send a deeply worrying sign.
Now, King Abdullah obviously had a long time to get to know Mr. Morsi's predecessor, President Hosni Mubarak. How important do you think personal relations between Morsi and Abdullah are likely to be within the context of the country's relationship?
It's hard to say. You know, it's been reported that Abdullah is not well. So I don't think that we should overemphasize personal relationships. For all we know, there could be a new king in Saudi Arabia in the near future. Remember that the Saudi monarchy is comprised of octogenarians. So I wouldn't put too much stock in that. I would examine how Mohamed Morsi views Egypt's interests in the region. What he's signaling right now is that one of Egypt's interests is to have a strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. We can only hope that he shows the same continuity of interest as it pertains to things like the relationship with the West and, of course, the peace treaty with Israel.
It would be interesting as well, I guess, to see how this visit plays in Saudi Arabia itself, because this is a country which hasn't had its own uprising. The Saudi royal family were quite clever at trying to play down any trouble, essentially buying people off. And now here they are welcoming the democratically elected president of their near neighbour, which was, although not a monarchy, certainly an autocratic regime. How do you think what's happening in Egypt is likely to affect what happens in the future in Saudi?
Well, the real unrest in Saudi Arabia hasn't been so much from the Sunnis, or at least according to reports. It's been among the Shiites, especially in the eastern parts of the country. It's not clear to me how Shiites look at this particular visit, but we know that there's already been unrest there, so that's going to be a continuing problem for the Saudi monarchy. One other point that I'd make, though, is that while it's true that Mohamed Morsi was elected, his actual ideology is not that different from that of Saudi Arabia. Remember that he's an Islamist. He's someone who very much wants Sharia to frame the basis of the legal system here, and he's going to need, at the very least, the image of Saudi Arabia to continue to bolster his religious credentials here. So, for him, going to Saudi Arabia, a longtime ally of Egypt, is a pretty good move, despite its autocracy.
Now, as you say, he's likely to go off to Iran in August. In September, Mr. Morsi's probably going to be at the UN General Assembly, and he's also been invited to meet with President Obama. How important are those two subsequent visits in terms of shaping what Mohamed Morsi's foreign policy, foreign relations are likely to be like?
We'll really have to see how Morsi uses those meetings. It's very interesting to me that the White House, President Obama is going to meet with him at the UN General Assembly in New York, but it seems has not invited him to the White House. I think that's a smart move. Washington is waiting to see what this new president and the Muslim Brotherhood will do, but isn't completely shunning Egypt as it frankly shouldn't do. How Morsi uses those events, what he says at the press conference, will be closely watched, especially as it pertains to the peace treaty, because in my conversation with Muslim Brothers, they are eager to either put that treaty to a referendum or declare that Israel is not keeping it or delay it for now, but in the future reassess it. So that is going to be, I think, the priority for the United States at these meetings, because it's the one issue where the Brotherhood has very clearly distanced itself from the policies of the previous regime here.
Eric Traeger of the Washington Institute, based in Cairo, thank you very much indeed. Coming up next, we're going to be heading a little bit south, a little bit east, and talk to the Finance Minister of Djibouti.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Perched on the tip of the Horn of Africa, squeezed in between Eritrea to the north, Somalia to the south, Ethiopia to the west, and Yemen across the Gulf of Aden to the east, the tiny country of Djibouti, population 800,000, is in a tough neighbourhood. Djibouti, a former French colony, tries to make the most of its place on the map. Both France and the United States have large military bases in the country, while the port, run by Dubai, is the best in the region. Ilyas Moussa Diwale is Djibouti's finance minister. A little earlier, he came into Midori House to talk to me, and I began by asking him about the challenges he faces trying to sort out his country's struggling economy.
We have, of course, as a African country, as a developing country, we have numbers of challenges in terms of economic as well as in social challenges. I might start from the main challenge we are facing is the unemployment of youth, which is still to be addressed properly. But because of the scale of the economy, which is a little bit yet to develop, we yet not created that much job required for our youth. From the other economical perspective, we have another challenge, which is the overall economy is for the time being still driven by the port activities. And it's now about diversifying our own economy and going into the larger activities and sectors, such as creating opportunities in terms of logistics hub in Djibouti for the Eastern and Central Africa, as well as developing tourism, because we have great areas of tourism.
When we talk about the port in Djibouti, I've actually been to, and we've covered it in previous issues of Monocle. It's a very good professional port. It's run by Dubai Ports World. It all works very well compared to other ports within the region. It's clearly head and shoulders above the rest. But once you try and get your goods out of the port, it's rather difficult, isn't it? I mean, the railway from Djibouti to Addis Ababa, it takes 2 days. It really shouldn't. It looks like a railway that doesn't really work very well at the moment.
Yes, we have the overall logistics, the corridor toward Ethiopia, specifically when it's coming to the train operations, it's getting a little bit bottleneck. But at the same time, we now started investing into a very important project, which is a new electrical railway, which will bring down that 2 days transit time to 6 hours. Which will definitely allow us to increase our own regional trade.
And in terms of your links with the West, I mean, you know, Djibouti was a former French colony. You only got independence from France in 1977. The French still have a very large base there of 1,500 troops, roughly?
Yes, yeah. About it, yeah.
And you also have a US base there of around the same sort of number of troops. What does that mean for your relationships with France and the US to have such large numbers of their forces in your country?
Out of France, which is the oldest and biggest base overseas, we have, of course, since 9/11, American base, which is getting bigger and bigger. And at the same time, we have Japanese base, as well as German, Italians. And we have a number of international allies and having their facilities in Djibouti. And it's part of Djibouti's responsibility in contributing to the international security, the fight against piracy. And definitely because of the geostrategical position of Djibouti, highly strategical in that region, determine our role into the international stability and security.
Do you worry at all that by having such large Western presence, you know, in a country which is majority Muslim, where one of the main languages is Arabic, that it might cause, you know, some concerns to some people within your population?
The specificity of Djibouti is really we are almost 99% Muslim country. At the same time, we are living peacefully our religion, and it's a very tolerant place. It's the, maybe one of the rare Muslim countries where we have different type of churches. We have the Orthodox Church, we have a Christian church, we have about four churches in the city of Djibouti. With that respect, I don't think there is any specific risk or threat about religion perspective. Of course, when it coming to the international forces established in Djibouti, it represents definitely a risk, a target vis-a-vis to the, those extremists. But at the same time, even though they were not present, the international forces were not present, still we would remain a target because we are a part of the international coalition against terrorism and against the piracy. And the area is a little bit unstable. Next to us, Somalia. In front of us, 18 kilometers, we have Yemen. But at the same time, Djibouti remains the only stable and peaceful place in that part of the world.
I mean, it's a minor understatement to say it's a little bit unstable in the region. As you say, you've got Somalia, you've got Yemen, you also got Eritrea next door. And you also have Ethiopia as well, which may be stable, but certainly has its issues with democracy. And many people would argue that Djibouti as well has some issues with democracy, that the last elections weren't as free and fair as they could have been.
Definitely not. It was very fair and free, and you can simply look after international observers' report. It was very fair. It was properly conducted. Of course, we might be having some criticism in terms of in representation of the oppositions. This is where the criticism can, but that criticism, in reality, it should not exist because the model of democracy we were having, the model of election was first past post, and it means whoever win the election take the majority, I mean the overall seats in the parliament, and we are now gearing up in order to correct that one and make sure that oppositions are represented through a proportional system. But you can definitely be sure that democracy is valid. Reforms are underway. We are looking after numbers of key reforms in order to get the country the most efficient democracy. But democracy have never been built in 1 year or 2 years' time. We are now independence in 77, as you well said. We started having and fair, free and fair elections. But at the same time, time has come now to make sure that minority are well represented into the parliament.
One final thing I want to ask you is about cat, the drug beloved by many Somalis, by many Djiboutians. Many people know it's a leaf that you chew. And whenever I've been in Djibouti, I've seen after lunchtime, lots of men sitting on corners chewing it. It takes quite a lot out of your economy, doesn't it, in terms of people don't tend to do much in the afternoons once they've been chewing cat, do they?
Yes, indeed. Unfortunately, we have a. It does. We don't consider, by the way, a drug as such. It doesn't.
It's not illegal. No,
it's not illegal. Yeah. It's. I mean, it's the happy hour time here in Europe or in America. At the same time, yes, it consumes a lot of time, and we maybe have to look after it seriously in order to make sure that it doesn't affect the working and the quality of the work there in Djibouti and in the region itself.
How difficult is that though? Because it is clearly such a big part of culture.
It's a very deep part of the culture of the region. At the same time, it represents economically, specifically to the government, a very important part of the budget, but at the same time, it affects maybe the performance and the quality of the hard working. But slowly, slowly, the new generations are getting rid of it.
That was Ilyas Moussa Diwale, Finance Minister of Djibouti. And we're going to stay in the Horn of Africa. This is a track by Addis Ababa-based band Dub Colossus. This is Uptown Top Ranking.
This is all we do. Ethiopia coming true. This is all we do. Ethiopia coming true.
That was Uptown Top Ranking by Dub Colossus. It is 18:26 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. And as regular listeners to Midori House on a Thursday might recall that 3 weeks ago at this very time, with me sat here in the host chair, I spoke to our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, about his experience as a judge at the 2012 New London Architecture Awards. He left us waiting with bated breath as the results were still embargoed. But today he can spill the beans, or it says here, should that be bricks?
It must have been you that wrote that, Steve.
I know exactly who it was who wrote that, Hugo, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us then. Don't hold us in suspense any longer.
Who won? You've all been waiting for 3 weeks. Well, yeah. There were over 16 awards and many sort of shortlisted things that we gave special mentions to. But the two overall winners, one was for Transport and Infrastructure, which was the King's Cross Station redevelopment by John McCaslin and Partners. And
That include St Pancras as well?
Or no, it's just King's Cross. I don't know when you last went past it, but King's Cross has had that awful 1980s facade ripped down.
Yes.
And the whole thing has been completely refreshed and given this incredible sort of funnel inside that links it to the buildings around it. And King's, this is part of a huge redevelopment of that area, which has sort of been going on and on and on in phases. And for the first time, you actually think maybe they might succeed in...
It almost looks like it's done now. It's not quite finished.
And so we debated for a while as to whether we should really be awarding it or giving it one of the top prizes. But what it's done is it's really knitted this station into the community and made it like the focal part of it. St Pancras is beautiful and amazing, but it's still very much a station plonked into an area that still is quite sort of down and out. And there's a lot of sort of homeless people, drug dealers and things. It's sort of a bit of a den of iniquity around there. Whereas what...
You saw with such a look of... like pleasure on your face, a den of iniquity.
I know, it's just quite nice to be able to relish saying that. But John McCaslin has done a lot of work to really make sure that the station and all the other projects, actually, which weren't really his domain at all, have sort of been welded into the fabric of the community. So quite a long-term thing that we're hoping it succeeds. But we sort of feel that the initiative in its first stages definitely was worthy of an award.
And it wouldn't hurt if Euston were to take a little look at what they've done there.
Exactly. We hope that that will spread. And there are many other sort of master plans in the area that we looked at as well and thought, well, you know, in a few years, maybe they deserve an award themselves. But King's Cross, exciting things happening there in London.
Excellent.
The second big thing was the Olympic master plan, which was controversial.
Yes.
But, I mean, just the scale of what has been done to try and ensure that this isn't a flash in the pan, throw lots of money at it for a month and then let it go to seed.
Do we really,
is quite extraordinary.
Do we really know yet, though? Surely it's quite difficult to tell at this stage whether it has been a success in that sense, really?
It's funny that you say that, because that was exactly the recurring theme throughout the day, and we did have 16 categories. And in every single thing, we were all thinking, you know, this beautiful building, the architect's blurb and all the people who came in to sort of speak on behalf of each of the projects that were nominated and shortlisted made them sound very impressive. But the thing about architecture is that until it's actually being used, and being used quite far down the line, like in 10 years time, has that building really lived up to its promise? Do people use it as the architect intended? You know, it just seems a little bit like the industry patting itself on the back.
Do you worry as well that there's a little bit of a sort of a Olympics frenzy when it comes to these sorts of things? Because there was also another award earlier this year, was there not? That the
Design Museum Awards.
Yes,
for the torch.
And the Olympic torch won that. And exactly. I mean, it's a very nice design, but it did feel as if it's like, oh, it's the Olympics. We should be seen to be backing the Olympics. Let's say this is great. Also, if you're to be slightly cynical, we'll get lots of publicity around it.
Exactly. No, you've hit the nail on the head there. And
okay, well, that's it. You can move on then. No, go on.
No, you're quite right, though. I mean, there is a sort of slight onus that we all feel that we must sort of support and say yes, and also that by awarding the Olympic torch, before it had even been lit and used anywhere, and that was in the Design Museum Awards back in February, it's a bit of a farce, particularly when sort of the big tenet of design is that it's function, not just form. In this case, though, the Olympic master plan is incredible, that the team has built 30 bridges connecting various parts of London in the space of 4 years. And I mean, that kind of infrastructural development is pretty much unheard of anywhere. So, you know, exciting.
Worthy of an award.
Worthy of an award, definitely, just for effort. And maybe in 15 years' time, we'll give it another award once it's actually proved that it works.
To prove that you're right this time around.
Exactly.
Excellent. Are you going to be talking about this tour on Section D?
I will probably be doing, yeah, going into more depth on this in Section D on Tuesday. So, yes, that's just really to whet your appetite.
Lovely. Okay, Section D next Tuesday, 900 hours London time. Until then, Hugh McDonald, a design editor, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. And coming up in the next 30 minutes of Midori House, we'll be talking airports in Australia, getting the background on an interview with the President of Burma, and discussing the finer points of Olympic uniforms. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Steve. 9 mountain climbers have been killed today in an avalanche near Chamonix in the French Alps, and the most deadly avalanche in the Alps since 2008. The dead include 2 Spaniards, 3 Germans and a Swiss. Syria's ambassador to Iraq has defected to the opposition, describing the regime of President Bashar al-Assad as brutal, as Britain and the United States drafted a resolution threatening sanctions. Staff at Libya's High Election Commission in Tripoli said they would announce preliminary results today. In Benghazi, at least 180 ballot boxes were being recounted after mistakes were noticed. New statistics show the unemployment rate in Greece has reached a new high of 22.5%. Meanwhile, health authorities have asked the Greeks to stay inside as chokingly hot temperatures of 112 Fahrenheit, 44 Celsius, have gripped the country. And Pope Benedict's butler, who was arrested on the 23rd of May on charges of leaking sensitive documents, will remain in custody for the time being, at least until the conclusion of an investigation in a few weeks' time, the Vatican has said today. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wheatley. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. The Australian government's decision to host the 2014 G20 summit in Brisbane rather than Sydney has been criticised by opponents of Prime Minister Julia Gillard, who believe she is simply trying to shore up support in Queensland, a former Labour stronghold where the party is now struggling. But Gillard has been quick to point out that Sydney Airport lacks the capacity for up to 40 jumbo jets, prompting a fresh debate in Australia about whether it's time for the country's largest city to have a second airport. Aviation expert Peter Morris, chief economist at Ascend Worldwide, joins me now. Peter, Sydney's got it coped admirably with the 2000 Olympics. Why does it need more airspace?
Well, I think that rates of growth, they're talking about increases to sort of 70, 80 million passengers. And clearly the current facility would have difficulty dealing with that. That said, you mentioned attempting to build a facility for 40 jumbo jets. Well, I think, you know, in the investment business, certainly in airports, you don't build just for one peak event. So you've got to invest over a period of 20 years. So it's not just a kind of one-off conference of heads of state that you're building for. But nonetheless, when you take into account that Sydney accounts for such a huge proportion, certainly of international traffic and a significant portion of domestic traffic as well, and Australia's growing, you put that all together, you can't stick with the same kind of scale of facilities as before, and also all the issues about curfews and restrictions on operation. So something has to give. But this is a debate that's as I understand, it's been going on since the 40s in Australia about a new airport for Sydney.
Well, indeed. I mean, when you look at the debate that's happening in Sydney, obviously the debate here in London about, you know, Heathrow and should there be a third runway or an airport somewhere else, and then compare that to what happens in countries like China, which doesn't have to bother with such things as planning permission and environmental laws and that thing called democracy. Do you think that, you know, democracies are actually falling behind a little bit when it comes to the economic imperatives of airports?
Well, I think there's this love-hate relationship. People love to travel but don't want planes going overhead. And the trouble is, you honestly can't have both perspectives running at the same time. I think if Sydney wants an efficient operation at the airport that is contributing to its economy, something has to give one way or another. And I think that if you ask the airlines what they prefer, they would tend to prefer expanding the current facility. Now, whether that's through virtual methods or physical methods, so in other words, changing the rules of operation, or whether it's actually building new infrastructure, I think they'd be interested to have that debate. But the problem is, the same problem in London, that if you up sticks and move to a complete new facility, the figures quoted sort of $7-8 billion, these things tend to rise in price as well, plus massive disruption, it's not an easy thing to do. So a gradualistic approach to try and expand your existing facilities would seem the kind of lowest cost maximum gain, but it depends which side you're on.
I mean, how realistic do you think it will be that within the next decade, I mean, obviously there's many variable political factors involved here, but how realistic is it that Sydney might get either a second airport or greater expansion, its original one?
I think you consider, given the costs involved, the expansion of the existing one is a much lower cost option and can create significant additional capacity. If it keeps on growing, though, if you're heading up towards 100 million, you see airports in Dubai and Doha and so on that have planned for those kind of numbers. And, of course, they've got nothing like the population or the rate of growth of Australia. So, sorry, they've got the rate of growth, but they haven't got the economic volume to the same degree that Australia has. So Australia could equally well justify as much as a Middle East state, that kind of scale of airport.
Peter Morris, Chief Economist at Ascend Worldwide, thank you very much indeed. We'll be right back with Gwen Robinson on the Burmese president.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the latest episode of Section D, we talk fat people and fit cities and ask whether our built environments affect our health. David Burney, New York's design commissioner, says yes.
Urban design architects, planners can do a number of things to increase people's access and encourage mobility in the way they design.
Mirko Zardini, director of the Canadian Centre of Architecture, says no.
I think that architecture is not the problem solving, it's part of the problem.
We also talked to New Zealand ambassadors about the importance of a home away from home. We discuss Lisbon's current design climate, and we take in a beautiful collection of 20th century Russian Olympic posters too.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
It's that time of year again when City Hall officials dab their concerned brows and mayors worry if they've raised their game enough to even get a mention. That's because Monocle's bumper annual quality of life survey is hitting newsstands with its ranking of the top 25 cities to call home. Pick up your copy to see whether your town is a magnetic metropolis or a city on the slide. The July-August double issue comes with many more surprises too, from five cities that are never going to win on metrics, but which we love anyway, to 10 surprising leaders you should know, to 50 things to improve your life. and our editors have been busy rounding up many more reports.
In the culture section, we showcase some of our favourite local heroes, from the record shop owner in Bangkok to the newsstand kiosk owner in Milan and the guy with a book truck in Tokyo. We'll also have a cultural calendar with all the best books, music, films and art for the summer ahead.
In the design section, we head to Marina City, a pair of modernist towers that is home to one of Chicago's more interesting communities. And we pack our swimming trunks and costumes and make for Lugano, where we profile this season's swimwear.
You'll find all this and more in the July-August issue of Monocle. It's on newsstands now.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, the Financial Times journalist Gwen Robinson this week had a very rare encounter with the Burmese president, Thein Sein. And on the briefing a little earlier today, Tom Burgess Watson spoke to Gwen Robinson about the interview. Tom began by asking Gwen to give an overview of this relatively mysterious character.
There's been very little clue about what he thinks. How has this man, who was a military commander even 10 years ago in sort of malaria-ridden jungles fighting insurgents, made the transition to be leader of a country living in this splendiferous palace in Naypyidaw, the capital, and sort of pushing forward this amazing reform program? So, indeed, how did I get it? That's, a lot of journalists want to know that. I've been covering Myanmar fairly consistently for the last 6 months, and I suppose over that time you build up some contacts. I really made an effort to get to Naypyidaw, which is not easy, and you know, we're all really pleased to get it and to be able to have this incredible opportunity to just put questions to him, like, you know, how did you feel? When did you first know that you wanted to reform this country? How did you come up through this system and then, you know, become a kind of civilian leader who's pushing reforms? So, yeah.
Gwen, I wanted to ask you specifically about those reforms. He's been in power now for, 18 months or so. What sort of changes has he personally driven? Do you think there's a desire on his part really to bring about change, or do you think he's you know, really capitulating slightly to pressure from other directions?
I think talking to Thein Sein, you do actually halfway through, you really, it does dawn on you, this man is very genuine. He talked about being born so poor and having a real sense of the poverty of his country and wanting to change it, but never really thinking that he'd be in a position to. And then talked about listening to people when he became prime minister first. He was appointed prime minister in around 2007, and he went around the country, and he said he really began to look at how ways to alleviate poverty. And I think the seeds of all that were hatched back then, obviously. And once he really got in the saddle, I think he's gone much further than his mentor really ever intended him to go, particularly allowing Aung San Suu Kyi, the opposition leader, back in.
Yeah, I was going to ask you specifically about Aung San Suu Kyi, because she's been doing this tour of Europe. She's very high profile. I think there'd probably be people around the world who are just waiting for the day that she's sworn in. Do you think that Thein Sein feels a little bit upstaged by her?
Well, I wanted to ask him that, but not quite as baldly, and we did raise the subject of Aung San Suu Kyi. It was Thein Sein himself who brought her in from the cold, I think. He reached out. Why? He put it in our interview anyway, he laid out the whole problem that he felt was still there with Western attitudes to Myanmar. He's not thrilled about the suspension of sanctions. In fact, his message was suspension is not good enough. As long as sanctions are merely suspended rather than removed, big investors are going to hesitate. If you want to sink, you know, $1 billion into an oil field or some kind of mine in Myanmar, you might think twice if you know that you'll only be able to do this because sanctions have been temporarily suspended for a year. So I think that was his message, actually. He was saying that this is not good enough, although we're grateful for even this. But he then made the link, saying, that he came to the realization that to get anywhere and bring his country forward from this situation of being a pariah state with sanctions against it from all over the world, he would have to engage Aung San Suu Kyi, bring her into the political process. But in recent months, I think the upstaging that you refer to, and that's a very good way to put it, has been very pronounced. Apparently, according to his advisers, Thein Sein is so low-key and relaxed about it that he never, they say, he never complains. Mm. But she headlined at the World Economic Forum in Bangkok recently. He was supposed to speak there. I think it was more probably the advisers that felt offended on his behalf that if a minority opposition leader, which is technically what she is, was going to be billed as a dialogue with a leader, as it was on the program, then how could you have the president appearing later on as just President Thein Sein on the future of the economy? So they cancelled, and that caused a lot of speculation.
That was Gwen Robinson of the Financial Times talking to Tom Burgess Watson on The Briefing, all about her meeting with the Burmese president, Thein Sein. And if you want to hear more of that interview, you can download The Briefing from monocle.com/24 or, of course, on iTunes. You're listening to Midori House. Go play your song now, just cause. This is 10 Strikes by O Spotter. That's 10 Strikes by O Spotter. It's 1851 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House.
Londonból ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London kala, Monocle 24 des.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
Londonist, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λοντόστα, τέμα ον, Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδαν, μπουρασε, Monocle 24.
Λόντον καρα, Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. And finally, on today's show, let's talk about Olympic uniforms. Yes, let's. Ralph Lauren has unveiled the new Olympic uniforms for US athletes, and as you can imagine, it's quite a preppy look. But some, including Wall Street Journal star columnist Christina Binkley, don't like the big pony emblazoned in the clothes, think it's perhaps a little bit too commercial. Also, they're wearing that most American of headgear, the beret. Now, for more on the art of getting it right when it comes to Olympic clothing, we have Christina Binkley on the line from New York. Christina, welcome to Midori House. Come on, what's wrong with them? They look lovely.
It's, you know, it's not the style. I think that the sort of Thurston Howell preppy look is cute and adorable, and can all have fun with that. Feel, you know, say what you will about the berets. The big pony, though, it's outside. It's both the American flag and the Olympic rings that appear on the other rest of the uniforms, and that's a bit much.
And why do you think they've gone for that? I mean, do you think anyone in Ralph Lauren looked and thought, God, you know what, perhaps the Olympic rings or the US flag should be a little bit bigger?
I asked them about that and didn't get a straightforward response. I think it was a very canny, savvy marketing move by them, and perhaps if I were running a big corporation, I would have made the same call if I could get away with it.
Now, how does this uniform compare to some other US Olympic uniforms over the years? I've been looking at a little slideshow, and I must say the beret, despite the fact that we consider it French, seems to make a number of appearances in previous ones. Hats generally seem to be quite important when it comes to US Olympic uniforms.
Yeah, which is curious because we're not really big on hats, so we're certainly not big on berets in any other corner of our life. We are big on logos, though, so the beret gives a nice logo right in the front and center above the forehead, the way they've positioned it.
It is indeed. And I think, you know, the one thing you can say, it is quite a stylish, preppy look. It's, you know, when you compare it to some hideous red jackets and the wide-brimmed white hats that your guys were wearing at Atlanta in 1996. I mean, and... I'm not even going to talk about the shell suits that everyone was wearing in Seoul and in Los Angeles in 88 and 84. This is at least some sort of improvement, isn't it?
I actually got a smile on my face. It kind of cracks me up to see athletes and the men are in double-breasted blue blazers. They look a little bit like they should go sailing. Why not have some fun? Those uniforms in particular are not for competing, and of course that's for the opening and closing games. And good on them for having a good time with the playing with style.
Now, obviously, at the opening and closing ceremonies, these are massive events, particularly the opening one, watched by hundreds and hundreds of millions of people all over the world. And every country is going to be trying to do its best to show off in some way. I mean, what do you think that this uniform is going to sort of say to the rest of the world about America right now?
Actually, when you put it that way, that might be a little bit worrying. We've got a huge financial crisis everywhere, and we look like we've just stepped off of Park Avenue in our limousines. I hadn't actually thought about it that way until you said that. maybe that would have been a better pre-financial crisis uniform.
Maybe indeed. And when we look at sort of the uniforms that the kit rather that athletes could be wearing here in Britain, obviously Stella McCartney has designed the kits, and they're trying to sell them. It's a big marketing thing. You go to any airport in London, and there's a big sort of London 2012 thing, and you can buy your Stella McCartney kit if you so wish. How successful do you think these things tend to actually be commercially? Do you expect people to be rushing out to buy that lovely blazer with the big pony on it?
I don't know about the blazer. That's probably the toughest sell. But I'll bet we'll be seeing those berets and the Stella McCartney kits all over the place. You remember the Vancouver Olympics? There was a Canadian company called Roots, and they're sort of the Gap of Canada. They had Roots berets and Roots clothing all over the place. I associate the brand Roots with those Olympics now. And I think that there's just so much money to be made for these retailers in selling these clothing and other accessories that we're going to keep seeing it unless the Olympic Committee puts the brakes on it.
Well, I think the Olympic Committee is unlikely to put the brakes on anything commercial. It's funny, I was in Schiphol Airport just a week or so ago, and it was just after the Dutch national football team had been kicked out of Euro 2012, the European Football Championships. And they had an entire shop full of Dutch kits, of the training gear, all emblazoned with Euro 2012, which was now all half price. Do you think that they might slightly worry, Ravlon, about how much of this stuff they're going to actually produce?
It's interesting. I mean, that would probably be important for particular sports. So you've got they need to be betting, of course, on particular sports selling more. If you look at the stars, the athletes that they are putting these on, they're pretty prominent. God forbid that one of our swimmers gets injured in some way and can't compete because perhaps the kit with his number on it wouldn't sell well. But in general, the Olympics are going to be American athletes in various competitions that are going to do well, and I think as long as it's not associated with one particular athlete, they're going to sell at some point.
Christina Binkley at the Wall Street Journal wearing her beret. I'm sure she's wearing her beret. Thank you very much indeed. That's all we got time for on today's Midori House. The producer was Daniel Giacopelli. The researcher, as ever, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Alex Jakes. Up after the news, this week's episode of The Urbanist. And here's a taste of what's in store.
We didn't like the name Smart Cities. It's about a city that's sensible, but also able to sense and respond to people. Because in the end, all of this is not about the technology. All of this is really about the people.
And of course, in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, it's the Monocle Daily. Until then, though, thanks for listening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.